I failed to mention that there are books available to be purchased. Paul, are you hanging in there?
Yes, thank
you. So we have some time for discussion. This is a good good presentation, provocative one, as I expected, and I think it's brings up a lot of questions. I'm going to exercise rights of the chair and ask the first question, which is also sort of question about implications of this. Of the IAEA findings and the belief, widespread belief, that there was a nuclear weapons program. And that is this. Well, two. I guess it's in two parts. I like your line about you may be done with history. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use it tonight. Because I think it is important to understand the roots of current crises, current problems from history. One question I have is, there seems to be at least a contradiction, that may be an unintentional contradiction on the part of how this alleged nuclear program has been used politically, and that is the following. On the one hand, there is the insistence by some that there is and always and continues to be a nuclear program. On the other hand, it has often been alleged, I think is alleged to this day, particularly by those who were supporting the Iraq War, that it was the Iraq War that got Iran to stop their nuclear program. And I wondered if you could just comment on that.
Sure.
And then the other piece of that, along the same lines, is the assertion today that Iran had a nuclear program and could restart at any time. And of course, that notion that they could cheat and in the context of a nuclear agreement, that they could cheat and restart a program is based on the idea that there was a program. But it also, there's a question then about the technology of actually being able to start a program or restart a program. So I wonder if you could comment on that as well.
Well, those are two big, the first one is not so difficult. The second one is a very, very big, difficult issue, difficult question.
That's why I asked.
On the first one, let me take the easy one first. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Iranian nuclear decision-making was influenced by the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime. First of all, the timing is wrong. The decision that is alleged to have been made, if you want to sort of, for the sake of argument, say that the NIE of 2007 is correct, that there was a halt in the nuclear weapons program in 2007. That occurred in late 2007. Clearly what did happen in October 2007, Hassan Rouhani was given the job of being coordinator of Iran's nuclear policy. They had never had a coordinator of nuclear policy before. And it does appear to be the case that lacking a coordinator of nuclear policy, both the military and the civilian nuclear agency, the AEIO, AEOI, excuse me, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, were taking actions on their own without authorization by the government. I mean, there's an example of this in Mousavian's memoirs, that is Hossein Mousavian, the member of Hassan Rouhani's team of negotiators, 2003 to 2005, talks about being told by Rouhani, and I can't remember exactly at this moment precisely when the conversation took place, but it was about something that had been going on in 2003, that the AEOI had introduced uranium into centrifuges in mid-2003 without informing the government. And that created all kinds of problems for Iran with the West and with the IAEA, because this was, of course, cited as prima facie evidence of a move that had to do with a secret nuclear weapons program. So this is at least you know, one of the cases which appears to be unauthorized behavior, a decision by one of the actors in affecting the Iranian nuclear program. And I have other information in the book that shows that that there was a debate going on in Tehran between people who were arguing that that a latent deterrent or a the nuclear capability concept should mean having the capability to enrich uranium. That was the dominant position. But there were people in the military who were saying, no, that, you know, a latent deterrent, a nuclear capability would mean knowing how to build a nuclear weapon. We'd have the knowledge, so people would know that we could do it if we chose to do it. And there were people, clearly, who were, you know, acting on the basis of that argument. And, you know, it was in October of 2003 that Hassan Rouhani was given the portfolio. And first thing he did was to put out a circular to all government officers saying, we want to know anything, any work that has been done on, relating to the nuclear issue. And if it has not been authorized, it must cease immediately. And this comes from the French ambassador at the time, Nicolo. So there was something happening. I mean, there was some work that related to nuclear weapons. I have no doubt about that. But the evidence is that it was not authorized. It was not an authorized program. There was no nuclear weapons program. There was no policy of trying to get nuclear weapons, which I don't know if that helps to answer the second question, but that would be part of the answer to the first question, at least. And you know, on the second one, about cheating and being able to restart a program, of course, I don't think there ever was a program. And could the Iranians easily start a program? My answer is that it would be easy. I think that there's a lot of loose talk about how many months it would take from the decision to have a nuclear weapon, the theoretical decision they all talk about, to have a nuclear weapon, and having the enriched uranium, highly enriched uranium necessary to have a nuclear weapon. I mean, first of all, the decision to go for a nuclear weapon is much more complicated than just a single decision to enrich uranium. I mean, you know, they would have to do all kinds of things, all of which would be arguably likely to become apparent. So there are multiple ways in which this would become known immediately. And, of course, you know, it's difficult to imagine Iran being able to have even the beginning of the process of enriching the uranium necessary to do to have the HEU without the IAEA immediately being able to know what's going on. But my main point here is that if you look at the history of nuclear weapons programs, for example, the Chinese nuclear weapons program. I've been recently reading about that, and it's clear that that decision, the initial decision to have a nuclear weapons program, was followed by a whole series of fundamental planning decisions that preceded the, you know, anything that had to do with enriching uranium. And so, if they made that decision, it would involve a whole series of planning decisions that would be very complicated and time consuming. And so I think this whole notion, this whole debate about how long of a breakout period we should be demanding at the talks is based on a complete fiction, a complete, you know, fantasy about what it means to make the decision to go for nuclear weapons. I think that's really the fundamental point that I would make.
Excellent. Okay, we have a lot of hands up. I'd like you to identify yourself and, you know, keep your questions.
Is it okay if I record the Q&A?
Any objections?
Does anybody have an objection to that? Okay.
My name is Alexander Fordham. I'm a visiting PhD student. I have a question about the motivation. The motivation from both sides. So on one hand, we have Mossad and Israel. What is their, in your opinion, what is their motivation?
Yeah.
There's obviously, if this plan was to go forward, there would be a regime change. It's not guaranteed that the regime change would be better. So that's on one side.
Right.
Another side, we have the motivation of Iranians and the domestic propaganda that was going on in Iran at the same time, as far as their nuclear program and how great Iran is and all that stuff. So you can comment on those.
Great question, two questions, really. On the Israeli side, I should point out a distinction which I did not make in my remarks, which is I think the regime change idea really kind of died a natural death by the beginning of 2006, the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, for the simple reason that they failed in Iraq so terribly, so obviously, that it became clear that they were going to be preoccupied with Iraq for the duration of the Bush administration. And in fact, you know, the key people involved in this, what Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, calls the cabal, basically left the government in 2005 and 2006. Douglas Feith left, David Wormser left, of course, Wolfowitz left. I think it was 2005 that he left. Pardon?
Rumsfeld,
of course, yes, indeed. So that was 2006. But in any case, clearly it was no longer realistic. And that's, by the way, when you begin to have the neoconservatives outside the administration, the people who were the chorus, who could be counted on to write in the Weekly Standard and other places to take the Israeli line, were saying, it's time to bomb Iran. That began in early 2006. The Israeli aim here, of course, was to get the United States to take care of their Iran problem for them, hopefully by, you know, using military force, which would mean, as David Wormser pointed out, they expected the United States to really take care of Iran, meaning they wouldn't just attack the nuclear program, they would attack economic and military targets and weaken Iran for a generation. Would be the idea. So that was always the Israeli aim in pushing this forward. Still is to this day, but I think their hopes of getting a war with Iran are certainly much, you know, attenuated and very, very weak at this point, if not non-existent. On the Iranian side, my view, and I have a chapter here about the Iranian the politics of the Iranian government on the nuclear issue. Originally, of course, I think they wanted simply to have a very simple nuclear power program. It would simply be Bushehr, the Bushehr power reactor. And then the United States intervened and prevented them from, you know, being able to rely on the Europeans, specifically the French, to provide them with the nuclear fuel for Bushehr. And that forced them into a decision, are they going to give up nuclear power entirely under pressure from the United States, which is, of course, a key factor in that politically, or are they going to get the independent capability to enrich uranium, which is, of course, what they decided ultimately. And that would mean defying the U.S. strictures against their nuclear program and going to the black market, essentially, and trying to, you know, use legitimate commercial outlets to get the technology, but perhaps using front companies or universities or whatever to try to get the uranium enrichment technology. But then later, I think, you know, as they got closer to enrichment, they began to think about strategically about what this significance of this capability might be. And they realized that they could also have a latent deterrent, meaning that they didn't have to have nuclear weapons, but if they have the capability for enrichment, the people who might otherwise be inclined to consider the possibility of attacking Iran would have to think twice. And as I point out in the book, there is evidence that this is indeed the case, that that does work. Latent deterrence has worked for the Iranians, because the Bush administration, the argument within the Bush administration, was indeed, in large part, the argument against attacking Iran, as was proposed by Vice President Dick Cheney in 2007, albeit it was not proposal to attack the Iranian nuclear program, but to retaliate against some future incident in Iraq that could be blamed on the Iranians. But the argument against that was from the Pentagon that, and the CIA as well apparently, that the result of an attack on Iran would be to persuade the Iranians that they should go for nuclear weapons, and it would accelerate it. And that, of course, is exactly the kind of reasoning the Iranians were hoping to provoke in their with their enrichment program. And then the second thing that they hoped for was to accumulate negotiating chips. And this was quite explicit. I have here in my book an interview with an Iranian political scientist who's now here in the States, but he was in Tehran in the 1990s, and he had a contract to do a paper on the implications, the strategic implications of nuclearization, of having a nuclear program for Iran. Not just for Iran, but for developing states, I think it was. And he talked to various, you know, high-ranking people in Tehran, and one of the things he was told was that they expected to be able to gain leverage in negotiations with the United States based on the accumulation of enriched uranium, low enriched uranium. And I think that is also true. I think that also happens to coincide with reality. I think there's every reason to believe that without Iran's having actually accumulated a large stockpile of low enriched uranium, and particularly the 20% low enriched uranium, or near 20% low enriched uranium, the United States would never have agreed to negotiate with Iran. I mean, you know, as a matter of policy, generally speaking, the United States, you know, would prefer not to negotiate with Iran. I mean, that's kind of big power, little power politics. So I think those are the two major things. And then on top of that, I think you have a very strong element in Iran, including the Supreme Leader himself, who sees the nuclear program as a lever for promoting science and technology in Iran. And the argument is, and again, I think there's some truth to this, that having a nuclear program is an important spur to Iranian science and technology. It introduces exactitude into technical education because of the requirements for a nuclear program. And at least that's the argument, that you know, you enhance across a broad scale, a spectrum of technology and science, the Iranian capabilities by having a nuclear program. So I think those are the three major things. Plus nationalism, of course, just general nationalist sentiment. I mean, that's been a very, very strong push behind this, because bottom line is no Iranian government can go along with extreme demands from the United States. Simply can't do it. It's impossible. No, public opinion is too strong on this in Iran. One public opinion's poll after another shows this.
Aaron?
David, why are we...
Aaron Bernstein.
Right? Yeah. Okay, Aaron Bernstein, MIT Physics. If you look back on this from the outside, which really my point is here, you know, I don't know all the details, comprehensive study. But I see a lot of big picture. Number one, Iran has a program which far exceeds any conceivable non-military needs. That's what I see. On the other hand, I see the longest, if you think that they really want a weapon, which I don't think they want this label thing that you've discussed, it's the longest period, gestation period, of modern history. If also, as you have suggested, they never had a weaponization, let's call it a technical weaponizations program to actualize, you know, construction of a weapon, then that should be provable. And when you gave the final scenario, I mean, we all worry that these negotiations will not bear fruit. And you omitted as a scenario that Iran could in fact satisfy, at least to some degree, the questions about weaponization, okay, in the summary. So I'd like you to put these elements together. You know, why do they have such a big
problem? Okay. First of all, I appreciate very, very much the point that you just made about the long gestation period. And I'd like to just pick up on that point and make one point that piggybacks on it. And that is something that I have discovered in doing research on these other countries that have had, at one point, covert nuclear weapons programs. Now, I'm not sure that I have all of them, but the four that I have looked at in particular are Israel, Pakistan, South Korea, and India. In all four cases, it is well documented in a number of places that U.S. intelligence knew about those covert nuclear weapons programs almost immediately, within a matter of weeks or months at the most. It was less than a year in each case that the United States had indications from people who were in very, you know, good, reliable human sources, human source intelligence. I mean, they had people who worked within the programs in some cases, who you know, came out and told them that, yeah, there's a covert nuclear weapons program. I mean, they had the goods on it. So that's just to point out that it's not just that it's a 30-year-plus gestation period if, in fact, you know, you're talking about a nuclear weapons program, but the fact that, in terms of intelligence, you know, this is the most dramatic kind of contrast between what has happened in all the other cases and in the case of Iran. In the case of all the others, they knew almost immediately. In the case of Iran, they still don't have the evidence. To me, that is dispositive evidence that we, meaning the United States, its allies, and the IAEA, have been on the wrong track all along. And as, of course, I pointed out, you know, with some motivation. So let's see now. Prompt me on the rest of your question.
Disproportionate size.
Size, yes. Okay. Right, right.
Relative to, you know.
Yes. Very important point, obviously, because that's always been a key element in the narrative. You know, one has to take into account, in order to evaluate that argument, that Iran, you know, has had the intention of increasing the number of power reactors. They already have gone beyond Bushehr. They, you know about Darkovan. Darkovan has been on the books for many years now, the second power reactor, which they've had contracts for. They've had commercial contracts underway. It's already started. I mean, they already started working on Darkovan. They need more than two power reactors. They need more than two power reactors. There's no question about that. I mean, in terms of their needs. And they've talked about you know, the necessity to have a much more ambitious program. But bear in mind that the international community has been telling them, no, you cannot do that. You cannot have that. And they've been forbidden from getting the technology. They've been put under, I mean, their technology providers, the Russians, the Chinese in particular, have been the subject of the most intense diplomatic and political pressure from the United States to not cooperate at all with Iran. At one point, of course, they were trying to get the Russians, not at one point, until 2012, the position of the U.S. government was that Russia should not help the Iranians have the Bushehr reactor put into operation. It was only in 2012 that, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was 2012, maybe it was 2010, 2011. I apologize for this. But it was very, very late. It was in the Obama administration that the decision was made to say, okay, yeah, you can have the Bushehr reactor. So bear in mind that extreme obstacles have been put in the way of Iran being able to make any progress, even towards the first reactor, let alone the second reactor, and not to speak of any reactors beyond that. But even so, Iran has talked in detail about, okay, I shouldn't say detail, but they've said at various times that they would like to have, you know, many more reactors, a number of more reactors than that. So in that light, in fact, what they have is too little, not too many. And bear in mind that the United States has also made the argument that this is too little for a nuclear power program. You know that, right? I mean, that this is too few. This is too few centrifuges for a nuclear power program. So we're having it both ways. We're having it both ways. It's too little and too much at the same time.
Well, it's too much in an economic sense in the present. I mean, it isn't clear. I mean, you clearly need less enriched uranium to make a bomb. You know,
sure, of course. Now that's beyond question. That's so, beyond question.
So
that's the problem.
Yeah, that's.
But you've raised the economic issue, and just bear in mind that if you're talking about economics, the main argument that's been made against the Iranians having a legitimate economic argument for their nuclear power program is that, well, they flare more gas, they waste more potential power by flaring gas every year than they could with a nuclear power reactor. Maybe that's true. I haven't investigated, you know, the details of that. It may well be true that that's the case. But there are two other things that they don't talk about. One is that in order to have a more efficient oil and gas industry, they need technology and investment. And, of course, since 1995, they've been denied that technology investment. And there's a real crisis surrounding the Iranian oil and gas industry because of the lack of investment in technology from the West. The sanctions against Iran have been very effective in that regard. And that's a major reason why they are so wasteful. But there's another reason, too, and that is because, economically, they're a statist economy. They're a socialist economy, if you will, a very crude socialist economy. They're not a market economy, despite the fact that if Rafsanjani had had his way, I mean, they would be a market economy, pretty much. And so, you know, it's like asking a socialist economy to, you know, have the most economically efficient option for its oil and gas industry. I mean, that's not going to happen. Can't happen until they have a lot of economic reform. So all those things play a role in the way in which things have played out in the Iranian nuclear program.
What about the last thing, that being able to prove they haven't had a weapons program? You stated that they already have shown the IAEA that they couldn't have, you know, that they showed them documents that they didn't have.
What I said was that there were investigations of six issues that the IAEA raised in their reports, suggesting that these were indicative of potential, of possible military dimensions of the nuclear program, meaning that they suspected them of hiding a nuclear weapons program. And in each case that Iran had turned over documentation that they couldn't refute, that they had to acknowledge, was dispositive and closed the books on all six of those issues. That doesn't mean that the IAEA has admitted that they didn't have a nuclear weapons program. Quite the contrary. They have said that they regard this evidence, particularly in the November 2011 report of the IAEA, they regard this evidence as quite compelling or quite, you know, strong or, you know, very convincing. And therefore, in effect, they have been accusing Iran of having a covert nuclear weapons program and suggesting that that program has continued after 2003. And you know, so I do think that Iran can and will convince the IAEA on one issue that involves these documents, and that is that the exploding bridge wire EBW studies that are cited in the alleged studies documents, the 2004 documents, if you will, that Iran had a program of EBW development, but it was not the program that is described in these documents. And they had already turned over information in 2008 to that effect, based on you know, details of their program, which were in a paper. They had two documents they turned over to the IAEA in 2008 about their own EBW program. And I think Ali Hynonen knew perfectly well in 2008 that he was not really on the level the way he described that issue in those IAEA reports. So I think that's the weakest link in the IAEA case. And it's very possible that the IAEA will say something to the effect that we cannot refute what the Iranians are saying about this. I don't think that's going to happen, though, on the Shahab 3 reentry missile documents. That's the one which is the highest priority and the one which is going to be most difficult to resolve. I don't think we're going to have a resolution of that.
David Wiley, I don't understand why inspections can't clear the matter up from either point of view. Iraq wants total credibility. We're wide open. Come on in. From the other side, we need the following inspections on the ground, A, B, C. The ones you've given us aren't enough for the following reasons. I just remember that the most damning thing about the start of the Iraq War was that they cut off inspections that were going on, and to that date had not shown any weapons.
Right.
No. So why can't inspections clear this up?
I think it can. I think you're right. And I do believe that the Iranians are prepared to accept far-reaching surveillance, monitoring and surveillance by the IAEA. Very, very likely going beyond the additional protocol in some ways. How far beyond? I don't know, but I think that they're prepared to go pretty far in that regard. I don't think the demands that the United States will make on inspections are going to be a problem in those negotiations. It's going to be a U.S. demand to close Iraq or to fundamentally change it into a light water reactor, to either close or completely change in some other fashion, but most likely to close the Fordow facility and to reduce the number of centrifuges from the present 19,000 to something like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, something like that. And I think that's where there's likely to be some real problems. I'm not sure. I'm not confident that they're going to cause a breakdown in the talks. I think there's a good chance, that they could still reach agreement if the United States shows flexibility. And that's why I do think that this political issue of the possible military dimensions is at this moment the most likely deal breaker of all the issues on the table. I mean, all the other issues, you can see ways that they can be resolved. You can see ways that would serve the interests of both sides, and both sides could claim that their interests had been protected. But on this one, I mean, it's a win. It's not a win-win situation. It's a win-lose. Somebody has to say, I lied in this one. And that's why I think the Israelis put pressure on the Obama administration to introduce this issue, because they knew it was a deal-breaker.
Excuse my interruption earlier when you brought the neocons. So I should point out that many neocons who grew up in New York during the 1940s and 50s and 60s had an Iranian pediatrician. Now, I'd like to bring up well-known facts.
And what is the significance of the Iranian pediatrician?
Well, for one, he was my grandfather. And two, you have many of these same pundits, like neocon pundits, Michael Savage, Wayne Allen Root, for just name two, who would call for war against Iran. And I remember having contacted them, remind them, hey, why are you talking about going to war with the people who helped bring you into this world? Now there are 3 points I'd like you to comment on. One, you didn't discuss the origin of Iran's nuclear program. Now there are 2 points I'd like to bring up. One, Iran's nuclear program originated from two sources during Mohammad Reza Shah's reign. One, here at MIT back in 1973.
Let's be really quick because we're running.
73, and with Iranian sailors at the Groton Subschool. Now they had access to information which can be gained on the open market anywhere. Two, you talk about the lies of the MEK and Israel. However, Mujahideen had been caught making trouble like this for years, even on campus here at MIT and throughout the Northeast. And the Israelis, including Netanyahu, have been doing this kind of behavior since the Waldheim affair. So this people should have seen this coming, and yet no one had ever brought this up.
I hadn't heard of the MEK presence at MIT.
No, the Shirin Center was founded by a professor who recently came out as being a member of the MEK.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I could list an example, but
John, that's interesting. That's new to me.
Then there's one third point I would like to bring up, namely, you also have the technology war between Israel and Iran. Good example being the submarine programs by those two countries. Now, even though those two may not have an open nuclear race, for instance, the conventional war, covert and technological war, it's like I said, with the submarines, the new Takuma class submarines Israel just got. Are fitted with nuclear warheads.
Well, exactly, yeah.
That's one of the reasons why many Iranian military technologists have had to base their new submarine designs on Swedish and Russian technology, just so they won't accidentally hit their own German and Italian allies who use the same technology they gave to Israel.
Interesting point. Yeah.
So could you please comment?
I don't know anything about that. I'm an ignoramus about that, so I can't add anything.
Let's get a few more questions.
Thank you very much. My name is Ansour Saltahiri, and I'm a senior fellow research procedure at the CIS, Center for International Studies. First, happy Nowruz. And second, I'm really thankful to your efforts and tireless efforts for revealing truth. And my question goes to the comparison between two incidents. This is about the one in 2003, I'm sure you remember the incident about the ship named Karina. And in the aftermath of that incident, the Bush speech in Iran, and you remember the whole impact of that speech. And the second incident is that of just a couple of weeks ago, before the current Vienna negotiation, again another ship captured by the Israelis about for the ammunition. And the impact of the two incidents is totally different. It shows the doctrinal change in the current and past administration of the United States. And the question goes, how can we maintain this current, I can say, peaceful approach towards Iran rather than warmongering approach towards Iran?
Well, first of all, in terms of that pair of incidents, certainly one has to be suspicious about the the background and the nature of those two incidents involving capture or interception of ships with cargo that was said to be arms for allies of Iran somehow, both occurring at apparently strategic moments. I know nothing more than I've not got any more information about it than you have, so I can't comment beyond the fact that they are, one should be suspicious about it, and it deserves close inspection. On what should be the strategy for trying to overcome the past, I guess is what you're really asking, if I understand the question. I guess I would like to sort of invite you to refine the question a little bit further. Are you talking about what should be the Obama administration's strategy? What should be the strategy of academics? What should be the strategy of peace activists? Or at what level, I guess, is the question that I would...
you mentioned the change of people. I'm trying to mention the change of policy. There are three notions that Bush administration used those incidents of carrying to actually convince the audiences for his warmongering approach. But the current administration is, although they faced with the similar incidents, but in a peaceful approach, allow Iran to.
Okay, so I understand better what you're asking. I mean, in other words, is there hope that this represents a paradigm shift, a kind of change in policy? Yeah. Okay, I understand. I would have to say that I'm a bit pessimistic about that. I tend to look at basic structures, as opposed to individuals, as the more fundamental factors that affect policy, obviously, and in this case, in the case of the Obama administration, let alone any successor administration in Washington, I'm afraid that the basic political factors here still operate fundamentally to stand in the way, to obstruct the kind of progress away from the policy that the United States has pursued in the past. And I think even if we're successful in getting a nuclear agreement, and that's obviously a good thing and can only have good consequences, but it still leaves, of course, fundamental issues that the Obama administration has said publicly that they're going to continue to press Iran on. State supporter of terrorism, troublemaker in the region. I mean, those two right there are enough to sustain the image of Iran as adversary for many years to come. And, of course, behind that is the continued power of the Israeli lobby in Washington and their influence over U.S. policy. That remains unabated. I mean, I have to say that I'm happy that, that we didn't go to war in Syria and that the AIPAC did not win in Congress on that issue, and that AIPAC failed to get the resolution that they wanted that would allow, a step up, more sanctions legislation, which was really nothing more than just, the blow up the Nuclear Negotiations Act of 2014 was what it really was. It wasn't a sanctions bill at all. It was, it had so many elements which were simply aimed at preventing the talks from succeeding. But despite the fact that the AIPAC failure in both those cases suggests that they could not achieve what they wanted to do, I mean, they were, in both those cases, they were trying to get the United States to go to war, and they failed in that. And I don't think they have the power to do that. That's clear. Israel cannot get the United States to go to war. But what they can do is to keep the United States in cold war with Iran for a long time to come. Absent a shift in awareness on the part of a large part of the population, shift in the way the news media covers this, we're in for a long journey here of high conflict between the United States and Iran, I'm afraid.
Okay, one last quick question.
Gareth, I'm going to ask you a question. I think it's a bit beyond the scope of your research, but I'm sure you've thought about it. So during the introductory few minutes, you mentioned the fight memo from Mohawk. And, of course, the you know, genesis of that idea dates back probably to the mid-'80s, if not earlier. What's your sense?
The genesis of some kind of regime change, correct. Certainly, yes, yes.
So what's your sense of, you know, what's the end game among that cohort, which then came into power in the early aughts? Now, you're here...
Of the regime change strategy policy?
Correct. Like yeah. What's the purpose there? And, you know, what if that didn't happen, what was the fear that would happen? And then just a related point, which I think does tie into that question. It comes up whenever people like yourself investigate, generate facts, etc. At a certain point, information is filtered through what one wants to believe, whether that's in Tel Aviv or Washington. And, you know, the corollary there is that we have to confront what it is that people do believe and why they want to throw the information up against the wall and see what sticks, or you know, why they're deluding themselves or making cognitive mistakes, or whatever. And so, what's your sense of where that's going?
Right,
with respect
to
your
group? Right. Okay, those are very good questions. And on the first one, on the fate of regime change, if you will, I do think that you know, certainly the Obama administration is not actively pursuing that. You know, there may have been at some moments during the last 5 years individuals who, you know, in private conversations within the White House or the State Department said, well, do you think, you know, prospects for regime change are getting better now because of the, you know, the 2005 election, sorry, not 2005, excuse me, 2009 election is what I mean to say. That created this upsurge in opposition activities. I'm sure there was discussion at that point in the Obama administration of, you know, whether the prospects of regime change had increased. But I don't see evidence that it became a serious element in U.S. policy. And I think, frankly, with the Rouhani election, that idea is really dead. Dead in the water in Washington. I don't think there's any active support for that outside the Israeli lobby at this point. So I don't see that as really playing an active role, a key role at all in U.S. policy since the end of the Bush administration.
So just to clarify that, you're saying the neocons wanted that objective by dint of...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was, as you indicated, you know, I presume you're talking about the Clean Break study of 1996, which Douglas Feith and David Wormser co-authored, and which called for the Likud government of Netanyahu to take a much more aggressive policy stance toward its neighbors and work with the United States, of course, to have the United States cooperation in this, but with the ultimate objective of overthrowing the Syrian regime, which would shake, you know, shake up the Iranian regime as well. That's always been the theory from David Wormser. You know, at that point, bear in mind that Netanyahu didn't take their advice. I mean, he was hearing from Mossad in 1996, I'm quite sure, a different tune, which was that we should be much more diffident about the Iranian regime. We should be much more careful about antagonizing the Iranian regime. Someday they may be allies again. That's been a Mossad theme for quite a while in terms of, you know, advice to the prime minister. They've not gone along with, in terms of their intelligence, not their covert operations, but their intelligence side, they've not gone along with this idea that Iran is a mortal threat, an existential threat to Israel at any time in the last 30 years. And to some degree, it's because they remember the good old days when the Iranians were their best friends and they were strategic allies against Iraq, of course, and other Arab regimes. They've never quite forgotten that. It's still very much in the memory of Mossad officials. So, I think that that's not something that goes beyond the neocons and their friends. Really, I don't think it's been very important outside that that circle. And on the second part of it, what is the motive? I think my own framework for analyzing national security policy is bureaucratic interests. I believe that the CIA has its own bureaucratic interests, the Pentagon and each individual military service has their own bureaucratic interests, and the result, that national security policy is to a great extent, not completely, but to a great extent, the outcome of politics involving the play of these various bureaucratic interests. So I think that, apart from the influence of Israel on U.S. policy, which has been profound on Iran, I think there have been bureaucratic interests that have been in play, which have supported the idea of Iran as a threat, a nuclear, nuclear weapons threat, because after the Cold War, that was very useful to the Pentagon and to the CIA to build a case for continuing Cold War levels of congressional appropriations. And I document that in one of the chapters in the book.
Okay, I think we're going to need to wrap up. Let's thank our guests again. Thank you for coming out. We have some side conversations with Gareth, and don't forget them.